Gang, with Stitcher's free mobile app, you can listen to your favorite radio programs and podcasts anytime and anywhere you want. Stitcher's wide breadth of programming lets you choose from the latest in news, sports, talk, business, and entertainment from the media industry's premier content providers. It's the easiest way to stay connected to your world while on the go and receive news that's important to you in a format that fits into your busy day. How Did I Get Here is on Stitcher. Find it at Stitcher.com or in your app store. That's Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get down.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time for How Did I Get Here? And now here is your host.
All right, hello, I'm Johnny, I'm your host. Welcome to the show. Yeah, thank you for listening. I know you get a lot of choices. There's a lot of stuff out there to listen to. Hundreds of thousands of podcasts just floating around out there on the internet, and you're listening to this one, so thank you. Thank you very much. I have a great show for you guys today. In turn, I have a great show for you today. From And You Will Know Us by the Trail of Dead, my friend, my old friend, Conrad Keeley is here. Conrad is a member of, and you will know us by the Trail of Dead, one of the founding members, him and my friend Jason Reese. And they started back in 1995. Jason and Conrad have been friends since they lived in Hawaii, since they were little kids, and then they stayed in touch, lived in the Pacific Northwest, then moved on down to Austin, started And You Will Know Us by the Trail of Dead in 1995. They celebrated their 20th anniversary a couple of years with a tour. And they put out their 9th album, and now they're currently working on their 10th album. So these guys have been together, great friends for a long time, making great art for a long time. I met these guys back in like 1997. We were both recording with this producer and engineer named Mike McCarthy, who was on the show a few years ago. Good friend of mine, he produced my band Gowdy and our first album Peep Show. He produced a lot of the Trail of Dead records, and he was working with them before people really knew about them. He was working with us before people really knew about us. He worked at this place called Hamstein, which was a publishing company here in Austin, and they had a studio in the basement, and he ran it. And so we were all in there recording, doing our demos, and things would overlap. And so I met those guys kind of coming in while they were leaving, or we were leaving and they were coming in. And then eventually, Mike and I became really good friends, and it was kind of like a family affair. He was working with them. He was working with us. Then my ex-wife, who I was married to at the time, started working with the Trail of Dead on all their artwork and photos and stuff like that, and just working with them a lot through a pretty important part of their development. So Conrad and the guys spent a lot of time at my house, mostly Conrad, because Conrad worked pretty closely with Tracy on all that stuff. That's my ex-wife. And anyway, over the years, I got to know Conrad. Then my ex-wife and I split up. Conrad moved to Cambodia. He went out there to the east. He was living in Cambodia. And while he was out there, he made this incredible solo album, which came out last year, called Original Machines. It's absolutely fantastic, man. He sent me a link to it. I started listening to it. I was like, holy shit, this is unbelievable. It didn't get the attention that it needed, but you guys need to get out there and check this out. It's Original Machines. You can find it on Spotify, on iTunes, wherever it is that you find music online or on your phone or on your tablet or whatever. Check it out. It's really great. I play, you know, a bit of one tune and then I play a whole tune there at the end. But it's really great. It's different than And You Will Know Us by the Trail of Dead. I wouldn't say the lighter side, but it's not angry and coming at you. It's a lot more accessible. It's super melodic. It's super broad musically. Like, there's beautiful string arrangements on some songs. There's some beautiful, you know, catchy hooks. It's very, very, very great. I've been listening to it since Conrad hit me to it, and I can't believe that it didn't get the attention that it deserved, but this is a great album. Get out there. Check it out. It's gorgeous, and I will have the Trail of Dead, all of them in here, hopefully, next year when they finish their record, their 10th record, And You Will Know Us by the Trail of Dead. You can find them at trailofdead.com. You can find Conrad Keeley. He doesn't have a website per se, but you can find him on Facebook. at Conrad Keeley Music or Conrad Keeley Art. His artwork's absolutely beautiful. Anyway, we have a great conversation. It was really great catching up with my old friend, Conrad Keeley. I hope you enjoy it. I sure did. Let's get down. Do anything with a band right now?
Well, just my band, but I'm capable of putting together a band for this.
Your
music.
Band, meaning Trail of
Dead. Yeah, we're working on a new record.
You are?
Yeah.
Where are you guys doing that?
Right now, we just got a spot at the Music Lab.
Okay.
Yeah, Lockout.
Old school.
Yeah.
I remember we used to have rooms there.
It's super convenient because there's that music store downstairs.
Yeah.
And like every time you need something, especially when you're recording, you know, it's like you don't want to run to Guitar Center or Straight Music. Just go downstairs, grab yourself an XLR or patch cable or whatever you need, a capo.
Well, how did you do? You recorded this record in Cambodia, right? A lot of it?
This one was recorded in Cambodia for the most part, like anywhere from like my living room to... Are we doing this? This is on? Oh, we're on? Okay, cool. Right on. That's super casual.
Yeah, it's very casual.
To like inside a taxi cab, like there's that one that's called Ride to Kampot.
I don't know all the names. Oh yeah, seven. Playing when I'm hanging out, but
track whatever seven or whatever. And I was just in a taxi cab, and because I'd missed my bus that morning. The bus cost $10, and I didn't want to wait for the afternoon bus that would get me there late in the evening. So I said, I'll just get a taxi. It's a 2-hour drive, and it's like $40. And I said, well, hey, no one else is going with me. I got this whole taxi to myself. How am I going to use this time? So I bust out my iPad and I wrote a song, started tracking the vocals for it in the back of the cab. And yeah, so everywhere became my studio.
So, but as far as convenience goes, what you're like, oh, we're working in this place and there's this music store downstairs. You can get everything. You don't have to drive to Straight. What would happen when you needed something in Cambodia?
Then you're kind of in trouble. Like, there was a small music store. There was a couple music stores that were generally overpriced. But the best way to get stuff in Cambodia was to look on their kind of version of Craigslist and just find stuff that was really underpriced because people that moved there were moving away and just having these sales. And that's where you could really get some great deals. Wow. So it was more like forward thinking. You had to, like, you know,
right,
anticipate that you're going to need this in the future.
Right.
But as far as, like, you see this rack right here?
Yeah.
If you didn't have a climate-controlled, like, AC environment, that thing would stop working after a few months.
Oh, because of the humidity.
The humidity was just brutal. So it wasn't like I ever had any, like, really nice gear. It was always kind of, like, on the edge of, you know, workability.
Total destruction, yeah.
Yeah. And the only thing that seemed immune to that was like an iPad and a laptop computer that I could always count on.
Yeah. So you said you moved back to the States.
I have, yes.
You have moved back to the States.
Yes,
so,
I returned.
I was reading on your Trail of Dead page that you guys couldn't go out on the road and do some shows in Europe because of your...
Well, currently, like, I'm trying to become a citizen.
Of the United States.
Yeah.
Have you were, though, right?
No, I never was.
You never were.
If I was, I would still be a citizen.
You were always Cambodian?
No, I was Irish.
Irish, okay.
I'm a bit of Irish.
Oh, yeah, your last name. Hello.
Yes,
so, but your family's in Cambodia, though, right? Because I was seeing pictures... I was trying to piece it all together through
Thailand.
Facebook photos.
Yeah,
okay.
My family are in Thailand, which is next door.
Okay.
And it wasn't that far, but they're worlds apart.
Right.
Yeah, and my Thai family had a very disparaging attitude towards Cambodia. They thought it was still like a war-torn country.
What took you to Cambodia?
What's that?
Why did you go to Cambodia? Why did you move there?
I was traveling around with my dad, and we were supposed to go to Laos and Vietnam first, but instead there was a monsoon or something hitting the coast of Vietnam, so the weather was going to be bad that way. So I said, well, why don't we just travel south, because Angkor Wat, we were on the Thai border right above Angkor Wat.
Mm-hmm.
We'd just go there. And it was really interesting because as soon as we crossed over, everything changed, you know? Like, Thailand has become fairly, like, first world country, you know?
Right.
Then you go to Cambodia and, like, there's houses on wood stilts. And, you know, for an outsider looking at that, that looks romantic. If you look at the reality of living in a wooden house with no AC, yeah, it's shit. But sucks. They look beautiful.
Yeah.
There's beautiful, picturesque villages. And, you know, in Thailand, we're like, bussing it around on these, you know, trains and buses and stuff, and nobody spoke English. We got to the Cambodian border, and we're like, well, how do we ask somebody, how do we get to Angkor Wat? And they said, oh, we'll call you a town car. And this, you know, black Lincoln town car comes up. It's beautiful. We get in, AC. It was like $40 to drive, you know, 2 hours to to Angkor Wat. And everyone, you know, and then I'm able to, like, meet people that speak English, and I feel immediately at home, you know. The expat community there is so intense. You know, you've got Germans and Russians and, you know, all sorts of people from all over the world. And I think, at least back then, and it was kind of a case where, like, people that went to Cambodia were a little bit different or weird, you know, eccentric mm-hmm. in many ways.
Yeah.
They had something they were trying to get away from.
Right, right. Or, yeah, it's one of those places where you...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or something that they came to look for, but they didn't know what it was.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's how immediately how I felt when I got there. You know, I wanted to escape the homogeny of the States and even Europe to some degree. And I wanted to find something that, you know, like, I wasn't sure what it was. But 3 weeks into my being there, I discovered what it was, and it was like all the musicians that lived between like Phnom Penh and this place called Kampot, and this new refreshing attitude to music that was, I just found so liberating.
What was that attitude?
Just play all the time.
Yeah.
No, you didn't have to book a show or something like that. You could just go down to the pub, meet your friends there, and bring your instruments, and then just play.
Yeah.
And we'd play every night. And it was just, like, so liberating from having to be, you know, in a place where you had to schedule your practice times, and then you had to book a show 3 months ahead.
Yeah.
And there was none of that.
Yeah, yeah,
you
yeah.
know? And so that was just magical, you know? And so suddenly I just found myself playing all the time. And I think the one, I mean, there's many things that I miss, you know, after coming back here, you know, not to, you know, the coffee being one of the biggest ones, but I really miss just playing all the time, because, you know, when before I left, I'd be playing like 3 or 4 times a week, just kind of like from formally to informally,
right.
Just go out and play, meet up with your friends at some open mic, a loosely called open mic. It's more
right.
like just people getting up and just jamming together.
It's funny, that's here, but we're not a part of that family. But that happens, there's blues jams. Like, there's literally,
sure.
like, but there's, like, the guys.
Are those, like, and I've seen those.
Yeah, I've seen them too.
Gone to see boys.
You don't go up there and play with them. I don't either.
I'm not, like, a blues guitarist, right?
Yeah, me neither.
Yeah. I've been going to these songwriter circles that my friend Aaron puts on, and those are nice. Well, there is a bit of a process, you know. It goes around a circle, and each people
right.
take turns playing a song. But for instance, like in the punk rock club in Phnom Penh, this place called Showbox, every Wednesday night was this open mic where it was just like the instruments were all on stage, and whoever wanted to just gets up on stage and they call out songs to the other musicians, you know, like, hey, do you know this one? You know this one?
Yeah.
And boom, you just start playing and entertaining the crowd. And the only rule is just to keep that crowd entertained, you know? And it's a pretty tough crowd.
Yeah.
You know?
I can imagine.
So they've got so many better things to, you know, like they're talking and drinking and smoking, whatever.
Yeah.
So in order to get their attention, you've got to really kind of like bring it to the table.
Yeah. But also in an improvisational way, almost.
totally improvisational. Yeah. And those are some of the best times, you know. You'd get some people that were passing through. That this happened a lot, you know, musicians that were just doing their, you know, their backpacking thing. They'd come to open mic with an Electribe drum machine or a synthesizer or a saxophone, just right. whatever, something that you wouldn't usually find in the city or, you know.
Right.
And then they bring it along, a hang drum, you know, like one of those metal drums that you play tones on.
Yeah.
Just whatever it was, you just bring it to open mic, play.
That's know? Awesome.
It's wild, yeah.
It's a very different thing than where you were at like 15 years ago. You know what I mean?
Well, 15 years ago I was here.
I mean, mentally, like, you know, you guys were putting out records and going out on tour behind them and doing these big shows and touring Europe and the States. And
yeah, that lifestyle was exhausting. I mean, I think at the height of our touring schedule, I got really sick of it, you know, and I didn't like the idea of hating my job, you know. I've always
loved my job.
Yeah, we
all got
into
this because it's,
yeah,
we love it, yeah.
We love our jobs. So I remember having some really low points where I felt there was a lot of meaninglessness to what I was doing. And I think it takes, sometimes in your life, you have to, you know, free yourself from whatever baggage it is. It's like holding you back or making you feel miserable, and go out on a limb and explore something. And then you can come back kind of refreshed, you know?
Yeah.
And so I feel that experience really helped me to kind of return to the music business, music as a business, with kind of more optimism.
Yeah, because it's a pretty bleak. If you come from the time that we were in our youth and really in the middle of it all, it's a completely different world.
It is, but Austin, I feel, still has a spirit to it.
Yeah.
You know, I know that a lot of people like to complain about how much it's changed in bad ways, but I like to look at how much it's changed and stayed the same in good ways.
Right.
And those are the things that really I love. There's no other town that I would have gone to returned to in the States. You know, certainly not New York. But coming back here was like, you know, finding that the comfort and similarity of a music community that, you know, everyone knows each other and are supportive, you mm-hmm. know. And that can be really hard to find.
Yeah.
There was a point where I was considering moving to Berlin, but I have friends in Berlin, some American friends, and they said that it's a really hard place to start a band and play regularly in a band. You know, there's not a live music scene. There's a little good touring music scene in Berlin.
Right.
You know, you can see great shows there.
Mm-hmm.
But for the bands that are there, it's going to be really difficult. And it's mostly like an EDM kind of DJ thing.
Right. Yeah, they're in a completely different thing.
Yeah. So I think that it's worth being appreciative of what Austin has that's unique. It's still unique, you know?
Yeah.
It's great.
How do you guys, after like, where you guys been together 22 years, the Trail of Dead?
Mm.
After that long, how does the getting together to make a record? And also, wait a minute, real fast, because you guys put out records and shit when you were living in Cambodia,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
How did that, what did you just,
I would fly over back here.
Back here.
But you know, if we were to do that again, if that circumstance arose, there's a studio there now, and it's actually near Angkor Wat, and I would probably have the band go talk. I've talked about it with them, you know, like there's a place that I would love to track us out there.
Right.
And maybe that's something for a future date. But, I just flew out here.
How does the making of the music happen? Is it you and Jason kind of are the writers?
Well, we like to get together and, you know, improvise as a group. And right now Autry's moved back in town as well. So, right now it's just the three of us, and we've never really had a method. Usually we set ourselves a kind of experimental challenge at the beginning of an album. And the challenge might be something like, okay, let's write these songs, like in a few weeks or whatever. And then we're going to record them like in 1 month type of thing.
Right.
And, the last album we did was probably one of the most difficult challenges I don't think I'll ever do that again. That was when we said, let's show up at the studio with nothing pre-written at all. And we're just going to improvise and cobble songs together. Now, it worked, and we got an album out of it, but it was so stressful. So this one, we've set ourselves more time. And one of the biggest challenges some of our newer challenges of experimentation for us is like, this is the first album that we're producing. We're not going to have a producer, okay. You know? Yeah. So we're producing it ourselves, recording it more or less ourselves. We're going to have friends of ours help out. And, but it's going to be, it's going to kind of like be us just kind of creating a, you know, something without that kind of authoritative voice that we've always relied upon in the past, you know?
Yeah. Who did your last record?
The last three records were done with Frenchie.
Okay.
And then, Mike McCarthy before that.
Oh, so you guys... That's like who you've worked with, because you were working with Frenchie. I think the very first time I heard you was like when Frenchie had that Tascam 388.
The first album was with Frenchie, yeah.
And he was working on it, and I went by when the bubble was way south, yeah. In that warehouse area.
And actually on that album, Mike McCarthy recorded one of the songs. I think it was the first song, Richter Scale. He recorded that. And then...
At Hamstein?
Yeah.
That's when I met you guys.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hamstein. Yeah. Is that place still there? Is the studio?
I don't think that studio. I think when Mike left there, that studio kind of went away.
Okay.
They might have sold off the stuff. I'm not sure.
Yeah. They still have like our master's tapes for Madonna for our second record.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know. They quoted us some exorbitant money for it. Because we snuck in and recorded that album.
Snuck in and recorded there, but we went in. We snuck back in and stole it.
That's smart. We should have done that. Yeah, because, I mean, I don't know that we'd ever get that remixed, but it would be nice just to have it. So, yeah, then the next few records were done with Mike, and then we had this in-between record where, like, Mike started it, and then it was finished by this guy, Chris Cody, who's done Yeah, Yeah, Yeahs and all
that. Yeah, he's a Brooklyn guy.
Yeah. And he kind of came in... at the end, just to kind of save the recording, because we didn't, you know, Frenchie worked on that album as well. But after that, working with Frenchie was great because, you know, his, you know, kind of ebullient personality helped to, you know, kind of help us. You know, he was kind of coach-like.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So that we've always had a great relationship with him. But I think he taught me a lot, you know, for now, I've come to this point where, like, well, I want to see if I can do this, you know? I've, you know, kind of learned a lot about recording.
Yeah.
You know, and you get to this point where you're just like, well, I think I can, you know, try this out myself, you know?
Yeah.
It's going to be hard, but it'll be fun.
You guys going to do it in, like, a studio, or you're putting your shit in music?
We're going to decide that down the road. Like, we'll probably, if we do, we might return to, like, Sonic Ranch.
Oh, yeah. I love it out there.
Yeah. I mean, we do, too. It's just a great escape. You know, it's a beautiful getaway.
Yeah.
And we did the last couple there.
Really?
Well, we did the last record and then the one the seventh, I can't remember, Losing Track. This will be our 10th, you know? So it's like 10 albums and you start to lose track of like how many you've done.
It's awesome. How is it with you? Because I've had tight relationships with people that went on for a while, but never like what you and Jason have. You guys have been friends since you were kids, right?
Yeah, but we were friends for like, I don't know, 10 years before we started the band. You know, 9 or 10 years. We had that common background of, you know, being island boys, so.
How did that work? You met in Hawaii, right?
We met in Hawaii, but only 6 months before I moved away. So we met, and we were living on the same street, and we became really close because we were totally like the misfits in high school, you know? And all our, you know, small circle of like skate punk friends. So when I moved to the Big Island with my family... to Olympia, we ended up in Olympia, Washington. we would write. You know, back in the day, we would write letters. You know, we couldn't even afford a long-distance phone call because it was so expensive.
Yeah.
Right? So we would actually handwrite letters back and forth. And I wrote Jason. I was like, dude, the music scene out here is insane. You know, like all these bands. One thing growing up in Hawaii as a teenager was like, there's nothing to see. You know, I think while I was living there, I didn't even go, but I think Red Hot Chili Peppers came. But for the most part, nothing. So I got to the States, and suddenly there's festivals, all sorts of shit going on up in Washington. And this was right before the whole thing exploded.
Yeah.
So you could tell, I could tell, that there was something brewing.
Right.
I could feel it.
Yeah.
One of the first bands, local bands I saw was this band Helltrout, which was Jason Morales' band. You know, Jason, who's from here, Tia Carrera.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So, and they would open up for bands like, you know, Soundgarden, Nirvana, the Melvins. The Melvins would play all the time for some reason. I don't know why, but the Melvins were always in Olympia.
Yeah.
So it didn't take much convincing for Jason to, like, you know, say after he graduated Hawaii, he just moved straight to Olympia, Washington. And we tried to start a band together with our mutual friend James from Hawaii. But at that point, you know, I was young, James was young, and he and I were supposed to be the primary songwriters, and Jason was just there to support us with his drums.
Right.
And it was just a clash of egos, you know, when you're kids and you can't figure out how to make things work together.
Yeah.
So we had a lot of growing up to do. So it wasn't really until Jason and I moved here to Texas that we were like, okay, yeah, let's start a band together, you know?
Yeah.
And it just kind of worked.
What brought you here?
I'd been living in Olympia for 7 years and just got enormously sick of it. I mean, the weather was maudlin, you know, like that overhanging cloud just, it represented more than just rain, you know, there was deep-seated depression.
Yeah.
And it took me moving to Texas back to a sunny climate, which I was, you know, coming from Hawaii and having been raised in Thailand, I mean, I'm just used to the tropics, so I feel good in the tropics, you know.
Yeah.
And we just felt immediately at home, you know. That embrace, that same embrace that I felt when I first went to Cambodia, that's how I felt when I first got to Austin. Like,
right.
I belong here and this is where I want to be from, you know.
Who were you seeing then? Like, where were you going to Emo's and to... Was the Cavity still open?
We went to Emo's. It was closed.
Okay.
It closed right before we got here. We saw Lee Ving play. One of the first shows was Lee Ving at Emo's. And I remember getting a bottle, like hit the back of my head by a bottle and thinking that was amazing. Like, yes.
I'm here.
Yes. The first show was Don Walzer at Emo's. And he played a week after he'd just opened up for Johnny Cash at Emo's.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they were like, well, hey, why don't you come back and play again next? But at the time, I'd never seen a show in Texas. I didn't know anything about Texas. So I go to Emo's and see this old country dude playing country music. And there are all these like punk kids that were doing this like two-step slam dancing.
Really?
Yeah, like they're in pairs, but like smashing into each other. I was like, man, Texas is weird.
Yeah, that is totally weird. I missed that completely.
I never saw it again. It was like this the one-off thing. It only happened that one time. But it wasn't until we fell in with these kids that were DIY, like making their own bands. You know, Paul Streckfuss from Glorium. Neil Bush was in Andromeda Strain. I know I'm forgetting a shit ton of bands. There was this band Gut. There's so many bands back then. And we were all under the radar because for whatever reason, it was hard for us to get booked at Emo's. We couldn't, I think Jason and I were even banned for some reason, just for being assholes. Maybe we were throwing bottles. I don't remember. So there we went through this period of not being able to play certain clubs. And we just had to make our own venues, and they would be some strange places. Like, I remember this one where we'd we got a show at this like mental institution, Neo's, and we played for the inmates who were like, you know, it was so bizarre. We played at an old folks home once. We would rent out anything, and we would go to San Antonio to play because that was another place that we
Taco
could actually.
Land, what's going on?
We'd play at Taco yeah. Land. For some reason, San Antonio embraced us really early on, and later rejected us after we got signed.
Because you weren't underground enough.
Yeah. You know how that can be. But yeah, so it was a really exciting, fun time, you know, to like kind of just make something out of, you know, whatever was at hand.
Yeah.
So.
How did you guys end up meeting Frenchie?
I think it was just through his band, 16 Deluxe. And I don't remember I don't remember the specifics of the meeting. I remember being extremely skeptical. He had to win us over, you know, because he was on this major label band. And back then we were super cynical about that shit you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially having come from the Northwest. But, you know, he's got that infectious personality, you know.
Yeah,
so
he really does.
Yeah, he just had that enthusiasm that he infuses into anything that he works on. And so that was how he was with our record. He's like, we are going to make an amazing first record. Your guys' record is going to be awesome. You know, that was kind of his spiel. And we're like, okay, we'll do it. We're going to get you in the studio while this one guy's out of town. We're going to record it in 3 days. Yep, and that's what happened.
Poor ZZ Top funded, like, so much of our early careers.
Oh, no, this is a different studio. Different one. This was something called Wolf's... I can't even remember it. It was someone's house.
Okay.
And our friend Chris Klein was working, was the engineer on that. And he just got this guy, whoever he was working with, snuck us in there. I think the guy finally did find out, and he was pissed off about it. But we got the record done. You know, we finished the record.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So I mean, what happened, like, when you put out that record? Because, I mean, there was so much of, like, for those of you that don't know, there was a point, at some point, my ex-wife, when I was still married to her, started working with you guys as well. So there was, like, a whole... There was like
that came a little bit later, right before
we got signed
to Interscope. Well, what happened was the first record got picked up and listened to by a booking agency in Minneapolis. And I can't remember even what they were called at the time because their name changed and stuff. But they heard our record and agreed to book a tour through the Midwest so that they could come and see us. And that tour was an utter disaster. I mean, we got kicked out of the Empty Bottle. We got kicked out of I think it was called like the 400 Club in Minneapolis, which was the show that the booking agency was supposed to see us at. We got it was run by the guy that used to be the road manager for the Replacements. And that show ended. Neil threw, like, shot a bottle rocket into the crowd. I smashed a glass against the bar because the bartender wouldn't serve me. And then that guy, that the old Replacements manager, just shoved all of our equipment out the back door. And then, of course, you know, this booking agency are just like, fucking no way, right? And then we played Chicago. We got in trouble at the Empty Bottle. We've since become good friends with the owner years and years later, but right. You know, he hated us. And we just had this disastrous tour. Every show was just like falling to bits. But it was also one of those weird successes, you know, because like people, the write-ups from those shows were great.
There was chaos. That was like, here comes chaos.
And so there was all this press, you know, college newspapers press. And so they continued to work with us throughout the period where we were beginning to record our second record. And our second record was done without any label. We didn't have any prospects for a label. But we finished it. We had a completed record. And our friend Jason Ward, who now does, you know, he's a mastering engineer, I think in New York now. But... he gave a copy of that to Merge Records, to Mac and Superchunk at Merge Records, and they heard it, and on the strength of that recording, they invited us to join.
And that one you did Merge. With Mike, the second one?
That was done with Mike, yeah. Okay.
There's a thing, when you were telling that story, I just all of a sudden remembered. I remembered when Tracy was doing some kind of video for you guys, putting together some kind of like EPK video, but she had a bunch of shit of you guys playing live. So there was like a stack of VHS tapes. And so one day, out of the blue, like she was watching him, I started watching him with her, and I found these great ones. I remember calling Einar. Remember my friend Einar, bass player guy?
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, we were always together.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I was like, you got to come over and watch this. I just remember, I don't remember where it was, but there was I don't know if you remember this. There was like a, you know how they have like those cardboard cutouts, Bud Lights, like they have a hot girl, but it's like human
size. Oh, yeah.
And like, I think it was Neil stopped playing and just started like beating the shit out of it.
That was in San Antonio. Like, yeah. And that was at a place called, I think it's called St. Mary's Brewing Company.
It was completely insane.
We got escorted out of town by the police. I swear, it was so crazy. And the police came and they're like, they were trying to decide whether they should arrest us. And they said, I was like, what have we done wrong? And I turned to the crowd who were lined up on the patio. And yeah. I was like, do we do anything wrong? And they're just cheering. And they're like, you didn't play long enough. You got to come back here and play more. And the police were just like, okay, we're just going to escort you out of town. Just leave town. We're not going to arrest you.
That's fucking hilarious, man.
But I don't even remember. We didn't really do anything wrong. I don't know why back then it was such a big deal to dance with a cardboard cutout of a, I think it was like a beer ad.
Yeah, it was like a light beer. It was like a girl in a bikini or something.
I really want to find that box of VHS tapes.
Yeah. They're maybe she still somewhere. Has them. She, yeah. Yeah. Because really, like, well, then I remember, okay, so wait a minute. So then you put out your second record. You got picked up by Merge.
Yeah, yeah.
What was the second record called?
Madonna.
Madonna. Okay, I remember that record. Then the third one was Source Codes and Tags?
Source Tags and Codes was the third one, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And that was done, we were signed to Interscope.
Okay. Yeah. So I remember this as well. I remember there was and now I can't even remember if I was there or not, which is the weirdest thing, because there's a legendary show that you guys played at South By with all those people coming to see you, wasn't it? And it was that what's that place?
Elysium?
No, down the street from there.
Red Eye Fly.
And there's an outside drums thing.
Went into the creek. Yeah,
the drums went into the creek.
Yeah.
But I can't remember if you guys had played a song. You played one song, or
it was like three.
Three. Okay.
But we were being egged on. Our friends in the band Mogwai were in the front row. And they were definitely, like, trying to encourage us to do some fucked up shit. So and one of them jumped on stage and grabbed a drum or something. So, yeah, the drums ended up in the creek. But I don't think it was that show I don't think Jimmy Iovine was there. He came to a different South By showcase in that same week, and that was at Elysium.
Right.
And I even think we had the girls in the Tosca String Quartet playing
with you guys.
Yeah, they did some of the songs, so we were able to make kind of like symphonic versions of our music, and then they quickly cleared the stage so that we could just get on with our regular destruction.
There's, you know, when you sat down to play piano, there's you what like what kind of training did you have? Some kind of classical training? Did you have like piano
a bit training? I mean, I had
there's
like
something like that
for I had four or five lessons when I was like 16 years old, but I was always into the classics. And it was from, those were lessons in classical music. And it was just from those four lessons that he taught me about just basically technique. And I just was autodidactic after that. I just taught myself. But I mean, I went through years without, always having access to a piano. It's always been intermittent.
Right.
But I always return to the piano. For me, the piano is that kind of foundation upon which I understand, harmonic theory.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there always has been like an orchestral thing it going through your music, even though it's crazy and high energy and you might play three songs and throw all the stuff in the creek. there's still like this, like, oh, someone in there knows what the fuck is going on with music. You know what I mean? Even in that, what's the song that you played on Spoon? Like, you played a...
The Mellotron
solo. Even that, like, it's like, oh, shit, that's like... And, you know, I was listening to some of the stuff on your new record. Same thing. There's some wide, expansive chords and...
Mm. Well, I love the classics. I mean, my favorite composer of all time is Bach. And PBQ Bach. No, just joking. I guess I'll always think in those terms of the symphony. You know, I was in symphony when I was in high school.
What'd you play?
I played upright bass.
Oh, really?
Contrabass. Yeah.
Wow.
And it was actually when I had they had to take me out of symphony. They made me get out of symphony in order to make up a PE credit that I didn't have in order to graduate. And when they did that, that's when I dropped out of high school. You know, I was like, I'm done with this. You know, fuck that.
For a fucking PE credit?
For a PE credit.
What a stupid. And,
it was. But, you know, I guess, yeah, education sometimes it fails us and sometimes it gives us what we need. So, you know, from there, I went on to Evergreen State College. And when I was enrolled in their programs, you know, it was some of the classical music education that I got. They weren't teaching us how to play, but they were teaching us about music history. And those were the things that I really took out of that. You know, I was enrolled in a module called Evergreen State College. Is a kind of a weird college. You know, there's no grades. There's no... there's just evaluations, and you take these things called modules, which are very interdisciplinary. So I took one called Introduction to Performing Arts. So we had to learn dance, we had to learn theater, and we learned music. And the music education was always on that avant-garde side. So, you know, we'd hear about old artists like Kurt Weill, not the modern Kurt Weill, but the one from the 40s and 30s. Right. And so... It was that kind of like out in left field type of thinking that always made me kind of that has informed my approach.
Yeah, you know? It shows. It shows.
Oh, good.
Yeah. No, it really does. It's funny because I think about that and I'm always like, yeah, you know, there was always a guy that it was always so hard. Like I discover all that stuff even now. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like I'll find some weird documentary on.
Brian
Eno or something, and then all of a sudden I do discover all those guys throughout the course of it that inspired him.
I forgot I had this. I wanted to.
I just saw that. Yeah. That's so cool. Yeah.
It's even has a date on it, 1999.
Wow. 9/29/99.
What's the guy that's not Neil or Jason with the glasses?
Kevin Allen. Kevin Allen. Yeah.
He always seemed like you the look straight the
same.
One.
You look exactly the same, dude.
I don't know, man. I've aged. I remember taking that picture with you guys and you guys that's were like, funny. Why do you want to take a picture? And I said, because some of you guys are going to be really famous and I'm going to tell people you guys are always hanging out at my house.
I want that shirt. I bet I wonder if I would even fit in that shirt. Jesus saves me.
Yeah, that's
that
was... amazing. So
it was so great to like thrift store shop back in the days. Cause like you'd find the craziest stuff for cheap, you know?
Yeah. So you guys, when you got signed, were you already okay with that in your mind? Like, okay, I'm going to enter this big business thing, even though I'm not into it.
Yeah. Because I think we thought we could infiltrate the scene, you know, the major label scene. And we thought of it as just another punk move, you know, like, yeah, we'll do what we always do. We'll just have a budget this time, you know?
Yeah.
We went from having absolutely no budget to having one. And, but, you know, we learned a lot. And I think that was an important education. I wish, obviously, there are things that I wish I had have known going into that. And maybe we would have done things differently. But for the most part, I don't really regret that. And When we left Interscope, I think I might have been a little bit bitter about, you know, like bitter towards them. Mm-hmm. But looking back, I'm so grateful, you know,
because they opened up a lot of doors and you were able to use what the resources that they gave you to continue after you left them.
And they never questioned our music. They never told us what to do, what to make. And they always put out whatever we gave them without question. They didn't ask to listen to demos. They didn't ask to hear the record beforehand. We just handed them a record and they put it out. And that was kind of the genius of Jimmy Iovine. You know, he knew when to just let the artists do their own thing.
Were you in communication with him a lot?
At the beginning, we would call him,
a lot. You had his number.
Yeah. But during the 4 or 5 years that we were on Interscope, he started to make that transition into business.
Right.
You know, he was no longer being that kind of like the executive producer of stuff. And so by the time we left, I think that was our falling out with Interscope, was just the fact that we couldn't get him on the phone anymore.
Right.
You know, and he was the only one that we really believed that he believed in us.
Yeah.
And so when we lost communication with him, that's when I was just like, well, I guess there's, you know, this is no longer, you know, a safe haven for what we're doing.
Yeah.
Because the rest of the company was corporate, you know.
And why do we have these guys?
Yeah.
They don't even have hits.
Yeah. So that side of it was it was frustrating to have my art question. That was probably more a problem than the music. You know, they would make me, you know, like legal department would make sure that I hadn't, appropriated anything.
Right.
Or it was, you know, tedious.
Yeah.
So, but also I think we wanted to, you know, exercise our independence. You know, when we left Interscope, I think it was, again, like kind of liberating to say, okay, now we're independent artists again, and we don't have to like do these obnoxious meet and greets and just weird things that you have to do when you're in the corporate world. And I mean, yeah, it was tougher. The budgets got smaller and stuff, but, you know, I think that, sometimes the challenge of doing something with a small budget is good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's healthy.
Yeah. If you're creative. Yeah. Yeah.
Working inside creative limitations is great. So like now you can't hire the New York string machine section for your overdubs.
Right.
You're just going to have to call your friends who play violin and cello and say, hey,
reveal and be like, hey, will you come over and do like 18 exactly. tracks or something?
Yeah.
Of it.
Can you do this? We'll buy you some beer.
Yeah.
You know, like,
still that, I mean, to me, that's still how stuff gets done. Like when a friend of mine asked me to come do something on a record and then they give you a check, like you're kind of like, I just came over here for the hang. Like I just came for came to eat your free peanuts, hang out, watch you record some stuff, play some stuff, and like, yeah, came for the peanuts.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's a challenge. These days, the whole music industry is interesting. It's like it's hard to put your finger on any pulse, you know? There's so much stuff going on.
Do you guys have a manager?
No.
No? Are you completely open except for maybe a booking agent or something?
Well, yeah, we have a booking agent in the States and in
Europe.
Yeah, but currently no manager. Two labels. So we're on a German label that we've been on for a few records now. And just started with an American label, Dine Alone.
Okay.
So, yeah. Very different. But they're, you know, they're compatible in our eyes, but they're very, very, very different people.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah.
What are you hoping to do? Like, I know that that's a weird question, but like, what do you, when you put out this next record, like, what's the 10th Trail of Dead record?
Man, just want to go on tour again. No. There are some challenges. It's hard to talk about those things because again, these are like sketches for an unscripted film, you know?
Right.
And I you don't want to talk about your script before
before it's
Yeah, before it's filmed. Things can change and stuff.
How old is your son?
He's four.
Four?
Mm-hmm.
How's that changed your...
It's, you know, when you have a kid, I guess you just don't... You're no longer, like, the most important person in your universe,
right.
You know? And that's a good feeling, you know? To take that away from you and just be like, okay, well, now things that I do, what I do for work, you know, this is the most important person.
Right.
And it's for him, you know.
Is he here or is he in Cambodia?
He's in Melbourne, Australia.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah, wow. Yeah. So, I mean, it's hard being with that much distance, but, you know, you have to think that, like, throughout history, like, most people had absentee fathers. I had an absentee father.
Yeah.
You know, I think the only difference that I want to make is I want to be an, you know, if I can't be with him, at least I want him to know that I you know, care.
Yeah.
Because my father didn't, you know,
right.
He didn't give that to me when I was a kid. So that's the difference that I want to right. make to my son, you know.
That's a good difference to make. I mean, I know what you mean. My dad was on the other side of the United States from me most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't like a lot of effort.
Right.
And it was noticeable by like a 5-year-old. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're like, oh, God didn't really... Out of sight, out of mind is what goes on when that guy, you know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. And I never wanted to be that. I mean, I didn't want to be separated from him at all. But circumstances always, you know, things yeah. are weird. I can't move to Australia.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where he was born. He's an Australian citizen. And
the guy's scattered all over the place. Citizens of the world.
Yeah, he was born in Tasmania.
Wow.
That was an interesting place. That's cool.
Were you there for a while?
Yeah, I was there for a month.
What happens in Tasmania?
A lot of logging. no, it's interesting. It's a not much happens, actually, but there's an amazing art museum there, the MONA. The Museum of New, I can't remember the acronym, but it's a really cool museum. One of the best modern art museums that I've been to. They had a bunch of Henry Darger stuff. They had all sorts of stuff. And they also support the music. So there's a lot of music events that happen there. But yeah, for the most part, Tassie is one of those places you kind of retire to. That's yeah. where Australians go to retire.
What were you doing there?
While I was there?
Yeah.
Having a baby.
Oh, yeah.
We always talk about having him in, like, Thailand and stuff. But in the end, I think my ex wanted to be around her family. Her family's from there. She's from there.
Okay.
That's where she grew up. Yeah. So he was born. And it's, you know, it looks like the Northwest. It reminded me a lot of Puget Sound.
Oh, really?
You know, yeah.
It's real green.
Green, foresty, and water. Just, you know, beautiful inlets of water.
Wow.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's a magical place, you know.
Yeah, it sounds magical.
Yeah.
Do you have a website that focuses on your art, or there's just a Facebook page?
I've been working on one.
ConradKeeley.com.
I'm so lazy. I mean, it's not just laziness, but there's a certain, like, anxiety that I have when I'm working on my website for my art. I don't know what it is, but there's just something like inner tension just kind of, like, contracts my gut. But I need to do that. It's something that I needed to do, like, 20 years ago.
Right.
And for whatever reason, I just keep putting it off and putting it off and stuff. Maybe because it's an something inside of me worries that if I focus on my art too much, it'll detract from music. My focus on my music, which is at this point in the next couple months, really important, you know?
Yeah.
I have to totally be focused on the music, but I never stop making art, you know, like
yeah.
painting is what I do when I'm like thinking about music.
Right.
So I'll pick up my brush, paint, sketch.
Now, album covers, do you make them? Like, do you, okay, I have to make an album cover. Or do you go like, oh, this album reminds me of this piece I already had?
Usually I have an idea for the cover well in advance. Not in this case, however, but I haven't come up with a cover for the next record, but usually I'll have this idea, concept in mind, and then I'll just have this block of time that I'll just devote everything to it. Like the last album we did, and I did this cover, it was all like illuminated letters, and I just knew, okay, I'm going to just, we've never done it before, just have our name on an album and just make the name, you know, the work of art.
Yeah.
And so I put a month of work into just illuminating all these letters like some old manuscript.
Wow.
And it took a lot of time, but that was all I did for a month, you know, pretty much. Yeah. It's weird because I'm probably one of the few people that even care about album art these days. You know, I don't know how many people really think of it as that important.
There's still some, you know, people. I mean, I was looking at this. I had this guy in here yesterday. I mean, this isn't like crazy art, but it's a crazy packaging with like a 20-page booklet and like a, you know, a guy, music critic writing the thing in here.
Yeah. Man, I should have brought you one of the art books.
It's.
I'll get one of those.
Yeah.
Because I spent a lot of time on the packaging for the solo album. I basically made a hardbound book of, you know, of... is a visual experience, you know?
Yeah.
And again, that took a long time. And coming out of it, I'm just, you know, you don't hear that much feedback, you know, sometimes you'll hear feedback. People will be like really appreciative of the art. But, for the most part, I'm worried that the album cover art is a lost art, you know, like
there's some people. It's gotta be because it's, I mean, unless, with the vinyl research, and I don't hear many people going like, fuck, did you see that album cover? Occasionally, there's a band here. Do you remember a band called Reckless Kelly?
Yeah.
Country band. They did a really cool album package. They even won a Grammy for it.
Wow.
But yeah, it's still being done.
Hey, how
but
come
it's
none
just,
of my album covers have ever maybe gone up for a Grammy?
Did you ever submit them? I don't know if they get submitted. They should have been.
I know. And an Austin Music Award while I'm at it.
No. Have you guys ever won an Austin Music
Award? No, we've never been invited to that.
Really?
We've always been outsiders.
That's good, though.
I don't even know that people, some people here don't even consider us a local band.
That's weird. I totally consider you guys an Austin band.
Well, so did I, but... No, we've never. I mean, I don't begrudge it. I mean, it's not like getting a
you're not
music
losing sleep.
Award is.
Yeah.
No, no, it's not. That's not why I make records.
No,
to get awards, yeah, no. I mean, there are some great album artists that are still like. I love. Is it John Baisley? He's the singer guitarist for the band. What are they called? Baroness, mm-hmm. And he does art for other bands as well.
Oh,
but the Baroness covers are incredible, beautiful, like Alfonso Mucha-esque Art Nouveau. I mean, he's a proper artist. I don't even consider myself a proper artist. I consider myself an illustrator, but he's a fine artist.
Really?
Yeah, you know, like I'm an illustrator. You know, more or less. I usually illustrate a concept or an idea, but I don't think that I'm making like these painting masterpieces. You know, my paintings usually follow a function, which is I don't know, in some ways they're exercises for me, you know, but when I can appreciate great painters, and you know, I consider this guy one of them. Another guy is the guy that does the Mastodon covers.
Oh yeah,
you know, he's fucking incredible.
Yeah,
you know, so there are these and these days, like, I'm almost overwhelmed by the talent, the artistic talent that's out there. You know, when you follow these people on Instagram, and you know, a lot of them are young, and a lot of them are out of work. They're just producing art on this amazing scale.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's humbling. I feel totally humbled by it, and you know, and discouraged. No, just
But it's good and inspiring to be able to access really anything all the time.
It is, but it overwhelming. I wonder if there's a danger to it as
there's
well.
There's a total danger to it. It's too much. I mean, that's...
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just think, like, our culture now and just... I mean...
We have to regulate ourselves as to how much we take in.
How does that coming back here, like now in this era of like post this guy being president, just kind of like this, and just kind of like floating insanity of just like, it just seems like
it's entertaining. But I mean, I was always on top of all that stuff. Even when I lived away from here, I mean, we all kept up on the news and sure. stuff. And, you know, just because you're living in Southeast, I mean, the internet is everywhere. Yeah,
the news is everywhere. And it's the story everywhere. Of this guy is totally everywhere. Just like it was when it Obama was becoming president.
A lot of people yeah. out there. But, you know, I'm stoic about this stuff. You know, if something crazy like this happens, there's for artists, you know, that could be a great thing.
Yeah.
You know, personally, I mean, of course, I wish that it would have been, you know, amazing if Obama could have served a third term. I know that that's against y'all's rules.
Yeah.
But at the same time, when I look back upon the arts and the music of the Obama administration, well, it's kind of a little
janky.
Bit
janky. Yeah.
It was placid, and it was what's the word I'm looking for?
It's not fighting against
anything. It was complacent.
Yeah, you're happy.
Extremely complacent.
Yeah.
And that's a complacency that I've always hated. You know, like as a young punk, I mean, that was like the evil.
Yeah.
The evil was complacency. And so I'd much rather have culture living under a very questionable administration that gets everybody pissed
yeah.
off so that people can create and have something to rally against and say something
yeah.
against. You
that
know
that thing that was happening in the late 80s when you were in the Northwest, the Pacific Northwest, there was that was after years of Reagan entering a third term of that
yeah.
with Bush. And,
we had a war.
There was a lot, yeah.
With, you know, yeah. That war sprung a huge amount of protest. And, it was a very politically vibrant time.
The Clinton years were not. I mean, that was a very, like...
Yeah, but there was something else going on that was, I think, kind of feeding the energy. It's hard to say what it was, especially here in Austin, but there was in when we were here, it, you know, like the beauty of living in Austin in the 90s was that you felt like you're in a bubble, you know?
Yeah.
All this whatever
yeah.
shit was going on outside of it, but we're in this kind of like climate controlled bubble.
Yeah.
And when you look back at different periods of artistic, you know, fecundity, you know, that's like something that's quite common, where you'll have this small community of people that kind of facilitate this communal creativity,
right?
You know, whether
yeah.
it's, you know, ancient Greece or Berlin and Weimar period or whatever,
right?
But I don't think that that's a history for all. I mean, I don't think that that's something in Austin's past. I see it in the future as well.
Yeah.
So it's yeah. not over yet. The story is
oh, no.
still going.
No, it's still going. you guys can go out and find this album, Original Machines, which is the solo album that Conrad and I have been talking about throughout this thing. That you made while you were living in Cambodia. It has how would one get the art book if they're not?
In theory, you can order it online on Amazon. I think it's about $50. Or I'll probably have some for sale when I show up at the show on the Monday show, or some of
that.
My other shows.
Some of
yeah,
the
yeah.
other shows. And people can find out where you're playing by going to Conrad Keeley Music on Facebook.
Or just my Facebook.
Or just your Facebook, Conrad Keeley. And they
yeah.
can see all the art on the Conrad Keeley art page
yeah.
on Facebook.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Trail of Dead is trailofdead.com, right?
I think even that's Facebook now.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know if anyone's updated the website. Maybe.
I went to the website. It didn't look like there was a lot of updates.
Nah, we're lazy when it comes
is
to
Is
it that.
Lazy, or do you think that like that's just kind of moved on? I mean, you need a website to have it there so you have a central place for people to go find the shit that you need. But when they're... just
yeah.
want to see what's going on, they probably just go to Facebook and stuff like that, don't they? And
pretty
Instagram?
Much. I mean, I think we're far more active on our Facebook page. So, yeah. Yeah.
Well, everyone get out there and check out Original Machines. You can find it where you find music. you know, Spotify, Apple Music,
yes,
the other places.
Yeah.
Is there anything I'm missing? It's good to see you. I'm glad you're back.
Yeah,
man.
Good to hang again.
I've been knowing you dudes a long time. I've seen Jason a few times at Seaboys. But I've been sit down and talk to him. Maybe when you guys put the record out, you can both come in and we can have like a...
That would be cool. We could get all three of us in.
Yeah, all three of you guys. Autry. Yeah. I don't think I've ever really met Autry. He's friends with my cousin Emily. But
okay.
You know my cousin Emily? Antonetti?
Mm,
you might not have been maybe? Around since she became friends maybe. With those guys. Mm.
But they would love to do this.
Yeah, that'd be great. Fun. It's good seeing you, man.
All right, dude.
Conrad Keeley, what a great conversation that was. It was so fantastic getting to catch up with my old friend. His solo album, Original Machines, is available where you download and stream music. It's absolutely gorgeous. I love it. It's super long, too, which is great. I have it on and just like playing in the house. I've played it like 5 or 6 times over the last week since I first heard it. I love it. I absolutely do. Listen, they're working on the 10th. And you will know us by the Trail of Dead album. You can find them at trailofdead.com. You can find Conrad Keeley on Facebook, Conrad Keeley /music, or slash Conrad Keeley Music, or slash Conrad Keeley Art. Just look it up on Facebook. Look at his art. His art's absolutely gorgeous. Gorgeous. Amazing record. Gorgeous art. Conrad Keeley. Great conversation. While you're out there looking up trailofdead.com and also Conrad Keeley on Facebook, you can like our Facebook page, How Did I Get Here? You can also subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, on your iPhone podcast app, on your Android podcast app, on Stitcher, on TuneIn, on Overcast, and anywhere where you find podcasts. You will get a new podcast every Tuesday and every Friday, 2 a week. 2 podcasts a week. Dig it. All right, let's hear some more music from Conrad Keeley's gorgeous solo album, Original Machines, available where you find and stream music. Have a great weekend, whatever it is you're doing. Let's get down. I was convinced that I was wrong. I was chafing at the thought. I didn't want to be with.